Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Town meeting day just a few weeks away, so we're going to get down to the municipal level to start today's show, and then we're going to get all the way up on the top of Vermont's only Olympic-sized ski jump, Harris Hill in Brattleboro. What we're actually going to do is check in with VT Digger reporter Kevin O'Connor on several stories that he's written about lately. He joins us this half hour. Kevin, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick.
Morning. And listeners, if you've got a question for Kevin, you can give us a call, 244-1777-877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kevin, let's start with your piece on charter changes. Well, this is a little bit inside baseball. It can affect a lot of our listeners, so it's definitely worth digging into. What needs to happen when a city, town, or village want to make a charter change?
Well, for a city, a town, or a village, and I believe there are about 80 of them in the state, actually 60 of them in the state, 60 cities and towns, and about 24 villages in the state have a charter. Which is sort of their framework in terms of what they can and can't do governmentally. But the way that the Vermont Constitution is set up, a city and a town has to get legislative approval to be able to make a change in that charter. Actually, these cities, towns, and villages also had to have the permission of the legislature just to even set up the charter. This is the way that the Vermont Constitution set up the state and its framework. So, what's been happening is a lot of voters go to the polls and they see that there's a charter change and they vote yes or no for it and figuring, well, whatever they decide is the way it's going to work, not understanding that even if the entire town votes for something, the legislature still has to put its sort of stamp of approval on it. What's been frustrating increasingly for a lot of these municipalities is everybody in town votes for something and then finds out that the legislature says, no, we don't want that. That's not in every case, but that is in enough cases that the municipalities are starting to say, we'd like to have more of a voice in this, and we'd like to have the state have less of a voice in this. And so that's the challenge of what's going on.
And, Kevin, is the idea of this charter that one of these cities, towns, or villages has, is this a leftover, a throwback to early days of Vermont?
This starts with the Constitution. This starts when Vermont was actually set up as the state. And the state constitution said very clearly that municipalities will have the right to sort of set up their own charters, but the only way that those charters will be able to be approved is through the legislature. And likewise, the only way that those charters can be amended is through the legislature. So, in effect, either the legislature has to vote a law that gives these municipalities more right to more easily change their charters, or the municipalities have to come up with a constitutional amendment to change that.
Well, what type of charter changes would this cover? What type of things might a town vote on that would have to be then approved by the legislature?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of the towns and cities right now are starting to sort of seek more approval, and that's causing some people to wonder, gee, I don't actually know if we want to give the towns and the cities more approval. What happens if they decide to have their own gun laws, for example, or what happens if they decide to do their own cannabis bills? The changes that the cities and towns are asking for is not sort of be able to do anything they want at any time. They're simply saying at this point that under the charter, there are certain things that municipalities are given the right to do. They just like to be able to do those more easily without always having to go through the legislature. One of the more interesting sort of examples of this was a couple of years ago, the town of Bennington found that a lot of their, or a couple of their select board members weren't showing up for the meetings. So people were being elected to the select board, not going to the actual meetings, and there was a feeling of, like, we need select board members who are actually going to be on the board and actually attend the meetings. So the town voted a charter change saying, if you do not attend so many meetings in a year, you will be considered absent, and we will be able to replace you. The town itself figured that makes a lot of sense and sent it to the legislature, and the legislature came back and said, no, that doesn't make sense to us. And so if somebody wants to be on the board and not go to any of the meetings, that's okay with us. And Bennington wasn't able to do the charter change. So it's this kind of stuff. It's the idea of the actual running of the municipality that the towns want, and cities and towns want to have more of a voice in. And it's like they're getting a little bit more frustrated that the state is really, in their mind, sort of micromanaging this stuff to a point where they feel that they can't actually do what they're supposed to be doing as a municipality.
Would Winooski's approval of voting rights in local elections for non-citizens be an example that the legislature has to approve as well?
Correct.
All right. So how often do charter change typically occur in the state?
Much more often than people know, because people tend to only hear about it if it's happening in their community. And for that matter, a lot of times these things are sort of these long, wordy ballot items that you see at town meeting, and you sort of
love those.
You know, sometimes you read them and sometimes you don't.
Right.
But no, there is actually, it's interesting, both for the House and Senate Government Operations Committee, they're the ones who actually start with these changes once they've been approved by the municipality. Both of those committees often at any time have, you know, several of them sort of pending. And I think that's another thing that's frustrating the municipalities is you get a charter change approved, and then it has to go to the legislature, and then it sits in committee, and then after it gets through government operations in one chamber, it has to go to the full chamber, and then it has to go to the next chamber. So there are charter changes that have been approved 1, 2, 3 years ago that are still sitting in the legislature waiting approval. And oftentimes that's one of the ways that the legislature could sort of make a decision without making a decision.
That's right. Yeah, just play a little stall ball. Do they often face opposition, these charter changes, in the legislature?
Yes, and it's. I think the challenge right now is there are members, and it's divided in the legislature. Chair of the Senate Government Operations Committee, she is the senator from Windham County. Her name is Jeanette White. She feels that the municipalities have a point here in terms of feeling like they do deserve to have more of a say in terms of what they do. She's sponsored a bill that basically would give municipalities more of a right to be able to work on self-governance. Again, not giving them the whole store, but just saying there are certain things that it under your purview that you should be able to have an easier time doing. That said, there are other members when this went to a vote in the Senate, about 20 of her colleagues agreed with her, but about 10 didn't. And those 10 had real concerns in terms of, we feel like we're, as a state legislature, a check and balance to this, and we are concerned that there might be some things that, and this is what's interesting about the way Vermont works, is there may be some communities that are so liberal that will start passing certain things, and likewise other communities that are so conservative that will be passing other things. And we sort of want to have a sense of consistency. So we don't want Brattleboro, for example, to be passing certain charter changes, and then in the other part of the state and the other part of the political spectrum, perhaps Barton, for example, passing something completely different. So there's a difference of opinion in terms of whether or not the legislature needs to have a voice in this or not.
So the legislature wants consistency. Has the legislature been consistent in the approval or disapproval of these charter changes?
No. And I think that's the other thing, too, and that really drives the municipalities crazy, is no, that there have been municipalities who've asked for certain things, and depending on who their legislator is or what time of the year that this is being proposed might get through, and then other communities will ask for the exact same thing, and the decision is made no. And I think that's one of the challenges, is that the legislature is arguing that it wants to be consistent, and yet at the same time is not being consistent, and a lot of the municipalities are starting to see this you know, everybody wants the same amount of ice cream in their bowl.
Well, what have you heard from cities and town leaders about this issue?
They decided, it's interesting, they really have decided, rather than sort of go up with protest signs and sort of make a public spectacle of their frustrations, they've instead decided that maybe what they need to do is try to get incremental change. And one of the ways that they're doing that is to ask for charter changes, individual charter changes, to say, hey, legislature, we're not asking for everything. We're simply asking, in our particular town's case, can we get can we change our charter in a way that other towns have already been approved to do so? And so they're starting to, Brattleboro, for example, has this on its March 2nd ballot, which would say, all we're asking for is a charter change that would have wording in our charter that says any provision in any other municipal charter in Vermont that's already been approved by the legislature is something that we should be able to draw from as well. Winooski has done this, Williston has done this, Springfield has done this. So the towns are sort of deciding one of the ways to try to see if the legislature, to get a message to the legislature, is if enough of the towns actually put this kind of wording into a charter change and then send it to the legislature for approval, perhaps the legislature will see enough of these towns doing it and saying, okay, let's just give that right to everybody, and we won't have to deal with these individually.
Wow, another local control issue. Kevin, let's look at town meeting day. What leeway have towns been given around changing up how they conduct it this year?
Well, it's interesting. Most towns that have floor meetings have decided not to do them, partly because the state has, both in the state and the federal government, it's discouraged them. And partly because when they actually look at the guidelines in terms of physical distancing and ventilation, that they recognize that they really don't have the facilities to be able to do this, at least indoors during the winter. So I actually contacted all of the city and town clerks in the state and discovered that about three-quarters of them, about maybe more than 200 towns and cities, have decided we're not going to even try to do any kind of a gathering this year. We're going to simply have an Australian ballot vote and try this again next year. Another probably quarter of the smaller cities and towns in the state, or pretty much just towns and villages, have decided, let's try to keep some kind of a floor meeting, but let's wait and postpone all of this until the spring. So whether it's April, May, or June, let's try to postpone a meeting that will do something outdoors that will allow people to have a chance to get together and debate in a more safe way. So come March 2nd, voters in about 200 communities will see an Australian ballot and make decisions there. The rest of the state will start seeing some kind of gathering in either April, May, or June.
And that ability to move it back from March was another thing that the legislature allowed towns to opt for. So with all this absentee voting and Australian ballots in so many of the towns, are we expecting voter participation to go up this year?
No one quite knows. One of the challenges is the legislature last fall allowed the towns to do absentee balloting. The other thing that the legislature did last year for the general election was said the state would actually mail everyone in the state a ballot. This year, for the town meetings, the state has given the communities, the municipalities, the ability to mail out if they want to, but has not actually said, we'll do it for you and we'll pay the expenses for that. So as a result of that, some communities are saying, if people want an absentee ballot, they can ask us, but otherwise, you have to come to the polls that day. And other communities are saying, well, we'll take the responsibility of mailing everybody. So it's such uncharted territory, and as a result of that, a lot of the town clerks don't have any idea in terms of whether or not this is going to boost turnout or perhaps deflate it.
I live in Colchester, and I received a card that said I could request, I could send it back in and request an absentee ballot, and then it showed up within a week after I send my card in. So that was received about a week ago. Now, Stratton has taken a novel approach. What are they doing there?
Stratton is the only town that on town meeting day during the day is going to attempt a floor meeting. There are a couple of towns. One of the things that's interesting about the legislature is the legislature said in its law in terms of making changes that towns could not have an online town meeting. Or most towns, I should say, they are actually allowing Brattleboro to do so because Brattleboro has a very unique representative town meeting where not everyone in town is allowed to be in it, but only representatives are. But everyone else in the state has been told, no, you can't do online town meetings because we can't guarantee that everyone in your community has access to it. And likewise, we can't guarantee that people from other parts of the state and country might be able to call in or log on and actually vote for your community. So Stratton has decided the way to get around this idea of we actually want to have a floor meeting on town meeting is, and Stratton again is a smaller town, mm-hmm. is they're going to have everyone who wants to show up at their town hall. They're going to open all the windows and they're going to allow people to sit in their cars in the parking lot. Now, this hasn't been done before. Again, the Stratton agenda is not a barn burner and doesn't tend to draw a lot of people in the first place. So they'll see. There are a couple of other communities. Kirby, for example, is one of them that has decided they're actually going to gavel in their town meeting on town meeting day only to then accept a motion to adjourn it into the spring. Mm. So there are a couple of smaller communities that have decided they'll have the ceremony of actually gaveling in a meeting on the 2nd, and then we'll have a motion to postpone it until the spring.
Now, one that usually is kind of a barn burner, gets a lot of participation, is Huntington, and it sounds like they're making some changes, but grudgingly this year.
You know, a lot of, it's interesting, the Secretary of State's office really has been pushing this idea of you don't want to be the one that has a town meeting just so you can say you had a town meeting and then find out that you've had cases of COVID as a result of that. Mm. That's just going to create more, not only liability for you as a municipality, but you're going to then have to spend all of that time in terms of contact tracing and perhaps, in fact, dealing with the virus yourself. So I think a lot of these communities, I actually was surprised. I thought there might be a little bit more pushback from communities saying, no, this is not the Vermont way. But again, I would say that there are probably a half dozen that are going to try smaller, real small communities that are going to try Monday night, just sort of meetings for the sense of show. But they're really encouraging people, don't show up for them. Mm. We'll have it just so we can say we did, but don't actually show up for it. Mount Holly, for example, is having it in its town garage on Sunday night, but they're pretty much telling people, we'll set up a couple of mail folding chairs, space them out, but they're not really going to talk about anything, so there's really no need for you to come.
Mm, interesting. And, Kevin, are all towns holding their town meeting days and their school budget votes at the same time?
No, and if it gets confusing, it can get even more confusing. One of the things I would say both the Secretary of State's office and the municipalities are encouraging voters to do is call your town clerk, go onto your town website, check to find out when is the voting, and also check to find out is your municipality voting at the same time as your school district? Because in a lot of cases, the answer to that is no. Some of the school districts have decided we don't need to have this be part of a floor meeting. We're going to continue with our March 2nd ballot. And those same municipalities with those school districts that are meeting on the 2nd have decided, well, we're actually going to postpone our floor meeting until sometime in the spring. So it really depends on where you live, and mm-hmm. people really are encouraged to find out either going to the website or calling their municipal clerk to find out if the voting is on different days.
All right, we have a couple minutes to talk about Harris Hill ski jump. It's fabulous that we have an Olympic-sized ski jump in the state. So tell people a little bit about it, what it's like and how long it's been around.
Well, it's interesting. There was a gentleman from Brattleboro. His name was Fred Harris. He went to Dartmouth College in the early part of the 1900s, and he formed the Dartmouth Outing Club. And he was what they call one of the early pioneer extreme skiers. He literally put a couple of 2x4s on his, tied them to his feet, and slid off a hill here in town. And miraculously didn't break a bone and survived and decided he wanted to build a ski jump. That was in 1922, so next year will be the 100th anniversary of this. And every year for the past 100 years, the town has had a ski jump. The whole hill itself is, on one hand, is the only Olympic-size ski hill not only in Vermont but in New England. But at the same time, it's run by volunteers. It's a total nonprofit, and it opens only one day a year. So it's an interesting contrast between being this hill, only one of six in the nation, that can actually host Olympic-size events, and at the same time, it's all done by volunteers.
That's phenomenal. And what do they have planned for next year for the 100th anniversary?
Well, the hope, first off, is that people will actually be able to go.
Yeah, right.
Because this year they weren't able to have it because of COVID. The hope is to be able to bring a lot of past skiers, so people would be able to see them. One of the things that's interesting about the hill itself is oftentimes if you watch these Olympic competitions on television, you'll see that ski jumps actually aren't on hills anymore. They actually build these sort of large structures with ramps.
Mm-hmm.
Brattleboro is interesting. Vermont is interesting because it's an actual hill. It's an actual natural hill.
Yeah.
That also allows people to climb the hill and get to the top and see how it looks from the top down. So that's the other thing they're really going to encourage people is come see what ski jumping used to be like when it actually was on a hill.
Phenomenal. Kevin, very quickly, have you ever jumped?
No.
Well, that shows how smart you are right there. Kevin O'Connor is a writer for VT Digger. Hey, thanks for the update on these stories, Kevin.
You're welcome, Rick. I appreciate it.
All right. Next up is CBS News, and then we're going to hear from another candidate for the mayor of Burlington. Independent City Councilman Ali Jang joins us to talk about his plans for the city. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents past and present with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly, the Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Burlington goes to the polls to elect a mayor every 3 years. In this town meeting, they'll choose from 6 candidates for the position. We've recently heard from incumbent Democrat Moreau Weinberger and Progressive City Council President Max Tracy. Today, independent council member Ali Jang joins me to discuss his candidacy. Councilman Jang, it's great to have you on Vermont Viewpoint.
Great to be with you as well. Thank you for the invite.
Thank you. And listeners, if you've got a question for Ali Jang or thoughts about Burlington's future, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ali, why do you want to be mayor of Burlington?
That's a great question, and I think it is about time for the city of Burlington to experience some change and a deep and meaningful change. I think I have all that it takes to build a strong team in making sure that Burlington becomes the best small city in North America. You know, 13 years ago, I came here with no English, not understanding the culture, but through my passion of hard work and commitment of building community, I became a city councilor, and there I worked in collaboration with the council to secure racial equity, inclusion, and belonging. department that never existed before, and I want to tackle issues around the public safety as well as grow our economy, you know. This is my time, and I'm looking forward to the voters of Burlington to give me the opportunity to lead this great city to the next level of excellence.
Mm-hmm. What are the first steps you'd take as mayor to make Burlington a great city?
Yes, the first step would be to definitely build a team, you know, a strong team of dedicated Burlingtonians who want to see the change that we are all waiting for, you know. And I think from there, we would also make sure that department heads reflect the diversity that exists here in terms of class, in terms of identity. Just to be sure also that our city finances are checked, you know, and in order to better support Burlingtonians to be able to live here, raise their children here, and, you know, just participate in the vibrancy of our great city.
Well, I know you love your city. What is the city doing well right now?
I think, you know, collectively, our response in the COVID-19 has been good. You know, there are lessons learned. And I think, you know, the council, you know, we will need to expand what we have been doing in the city with the surrounding communities, such as, you know, Winooski, South Burlington. You know, I think we have done well as a city and as a state. You know, in that front, we are doing very well. Yeah.
And where do you think it's failing its citizens?
Yes, I mean, in terms of transparency, I mean, I think it's one key component. And also another aspect is the dysfunctionality that exists currently with the city council and the administration. You know, we are not united, and it is about time for us to be united. You know, and also we have not tackled the issue about the public safety, you know, and there has been a lot of marches about the police, and I think the city could have done better by taking action and not reacting.
We'll get to more on that, but I want to know what specific measures you would take to make Burlington, as you call it, a more fair, just, and equitable city that works for everyone.
Yes. I think, you know, it's a lot, and it is all about bringing, making sure that we identify what we have in common, you know, what is really working very well, what can we build on, and what can we change. You know, I think in terms of vibrancy, our downtown is a very different neighborhood, and it should not be considered as any other neighborhood. And I believe that, you know, we should make it vibrant. You know, that's one. Two, I think it will be imperative for the city of Burlington under my leadership to learn to live within our means. There has been a lot of borrowing, a lot of bounds that I don't think Burlingtonians need, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, another aspect, we are over-regulating the city. You know, a lot of, let's say, laws and legislations are being passed. And to me, sometimes it is good to take care of what the city owns, such as the streets, the sidewalks, the basic maintenance. We should strive for that, while also making sure we step out from the freedom that Burlingtonians should have within their homes. And one ballot item about the thermal energy, to me, is not a good idea. You know, we should allow people to make the choices they would want to see within their own homes while we maintain and just protect everyone in the city. Yeah.
Ali, you have a much different background and experiences than your opponents. So tell us a little bit about your story.
Yes. So 13 years ago, I came here, like I said earlier, and I did not understand the English, you know. I did not understand the culture, but working with kids gave me a huge insight of what this community is about. And automatically, I fell in love, you know. I worked with your children, Burlington children, in teaching my artistic skills, in teaching them French, and in learning also from them, you know. My educational background is in public international law, but what I do in this community is all about building a stronger and more vibrant community. I work directly with new Americans, you know, supporting them to understand the American culture, to get involved in their children's education. I'm also the founder and manager of the Bloomington School District Parent University. You know, I created programs and projects geared toward helping people to live with dignity in this great city. You know, I'm an immigrant and a person of color, you know, a parent, and my wife is white. Our kids are mixed races. So my story is the story of many people who just want to bring the humanity of the person, despite their race, their religion, their age, at the forefront, and supporting individuals to get better. And with the resources that we have here, I do believe that we need an inclusive leadership transmission to lead this great city.
So how do you think this makes you a more qualified person to be mayor of Burlington than your opponents?
Yes, I mean, I think both of my main opponents were elected at the same time, one as mayor and one as city council, you know, and I think the issues such as affordable housing has always been here. I will bring a different set of thinking, right? And I am the only candidate, I mean, one of the only candidates who is not running under any party lines. To me, party affiliation is holding us back. And I want to build a unified system of government that responds to the need of the people, you know. And my story is just compelling. And my achievements within just 13 years ago, I mean, is just amazing. And that's what I would want to continue to do. And that's a big difference between me and my opponents.
Ali, is there anything you would have done differently for the city as mayor during this year of the COVID pandemic?
Yes. I mean, I think, one, our response was not coordinated enough to include surrounding communities such as Winooski and South Burlington, you know. Mm-hmm. We've been providing some information about the COVID, but it would have been greater, you know, if it was a unified approach. That's one. And I think in terms of number two, I would have also make sure that businesses received adequate support. You know, we have done a couple, but we could have, you know, strengthened that support to local businesses, you know, and also promote more inclusion for those who do not speak English very well. You know, in the beginning, it was rough, but over time, we have done better, you know, and I think starting it from the beginning would have been better. But, you know, COVID also was new, and all of us, we just scrambled to do the right thing, but it is a lesson learned, and I think next time around, we will need to change the way we do it. And also, I mean, the city today do not have a public health emergency manager, and as the next mayor, I think it would be imperative to appoint someone who would coordinate that effort, not only about the COVID, but also about other public emergencies such as the opiate crisis. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier about downtown Burlington, and I want to look at City Place, the city in a bit of a precarious place with this. What's the right way forward now with City Place?
So the right way forward to me is to approve the settlement that currently exists between the city and the developers, right? Mm-hmm. That's one. And I think number two is to also try to find a way to better support these local developers. These are our neighbors, these are our friends, and these are respected developers in here. Now, is it better for the city to watch from distance, see them succeed or not succeed? But I think under my administration, I will be there with them until this project is completed. And also after that, we will then think about what other projects we need to have with similar size in our downtown. Yeah.
Do you think that having outside developers and not being intimately involved with the process so far has been why we're sitting there looking at that big pit in the middle of downtown Burlington?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the pit issue, one, it was, you know, pushed very hard to the Burlingtonians. It was a pipe project dream. It was a big project, and I think it seems that the current administration pushed it on the people, while many people wanted to take the time and to reduce the size, but we did not listen, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think, yes, private developers that are, that do not live among us could bring some level of, lack of transparency, a better communication. But working with people who live among us, I mean, who are respected, I think, you know, we are very hopeful that definitely this project will need to move forward. And also we need to learn from the mistakes, allowing to demolish the mall mm-hmm. without having a security in terms of financing from the developers that do not live here, you know. And I just hope that it is a lesson learned and we will be careful and try to lead carefully in making sure that this project will be finished.
Moving away from City Place, what else needs to be done downtown?
Yes, I think I am the only candidate specifically talking about the Downtown Improvement District, and which was a ballot item that was also presented. It was rushed, and it did not receive enough community input. Now, under my administration, I would want to bring it, because downtown need to be vibrant, need to be safe, and need to be also competitive within the region, you know. And, you know, the Downtown Improvement District is a concept that I would want to see through, and also aligning better Church Street Marketplace, downtown, and the waterfront. Both of them combined, we receive around 4 million residents, 4 million visitors per year, you know. And I think those are elements that I would want to see as the next mayor in making sure that we have a safe, vibrant, and diverse set of businesses in our downtown.
Ali, another area you touched on before, trust in the city's police department seems to be waning. What steps do you take to make sure that there are adequate staffing levels, that Burlingtonians are safe, and that trust is restored?
Yeah. Yes. And I think first and foremost, it will be important to have a police chief, someone that will be hired to drive this reform. We all agree that police reform is needed in the city, right? We also all understand that these police officers, they come across so many hardship all the time, and I did not like the way that they were treated, and they are still being treated, you know. Mm-hmm. And in order to rebuild trust, we need to have someone who's transparent, who's not reactionary, someone who acts at the right time when an issue is in front of us. But my plan is as clear as this. Once we hire a police chief, then I will appoint a 9-member task force that will work in coordination with him or her, you know, in driving this change. And the change include changing the culture, you know, exploring the creation of an independent oversight body that is different from the police commission that currently exists, right? The policies need to be strengthened in terms of the wearing of body cameras, you know, rebuilding trust within the community, and also making sure that also the police officers have the best training of the 21st century in order to do their jobs right. But I will not allow any police officer or who is not serving well, who is not serving us well, to still be under the city's payroll. Yeah.
You're calling for an Office of Community Wealth Building. So what would be its mission and how would it be accomplished?
Yes. So I think in Burlington and in the state of Vermont, we definitely do have leading businesses that are thriving here. You know, Cafe Marijuana is one example. The Land Trust is one example. The co-op is one example, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we need to think about community wealth building outside from a private perspective alone. And I am talking about a public wealth building where community members with ideas to create a business or the co-op are receiving the adequate support necessary from the municipal government in terms of research, in terms of the laws and regulations, in terms of grants, et cetera. You know, and I think already we have great, wonderful ideas that are striving without the input or the support from the municipal government. And I think with now an important level of support from the government, then, you know, ideas can be explored and also implemented so that everyone can grow and also can strengthen the sense of belonging so people can stay here. Mm. Yeah.
Affordable housing in Burlington is a crucial need. What specific steps do you want to see taken to increase the number of truly affordable housing units in the city?
Yep. Yes, that's a big problem. And like I said earlier, we currently have a mayor with a developer background, and this issue is still in front of us. What I would do first and foremost is to bring organizations currently doing this work sporadically, you know, on their own areas, right? I want to bring them all together, you know, and then think about what is possible in terms of creating more affordable housing. And together we would have a set of metrics, you know, have goals every year, 100 new homes that are affordable will be created. And together we will definitely make it happen. That's one. And two, I will strive for bringing new developers with a new concept, basically to create homes that are geared toward renting, and those renters will also over time own it. Rent-to-own concept, right? Mm-hmm. It's two. And I think the three, we would need to change the zoning laws that currently exist in our downtown. We do not have land. We are surrounded by a beautiful lake. You know, and it is about time for our downtown to learn to build up, you know, and I think those are critical changes that I will be striving for in order to create more homes that exist here. And also, I want to look at this issue not from an affordable housing perspective alone. And I want to talk about, you know, how do we also support the houseless, the homelessness that exists here in this community? How do we eradicate it once and for all? And I'm talking about the tiny home village that we will need to create soon.
We only have about a minute left. I hate to ask a big question at the end, but I'm going to have to, because this is important as well, as far as education. What's your overall plan to make things right in the school district in Burlington?
Yes, that's a great question. And I think, you know, over two-thirds of the taxes being collected goes to the school district, while only one-third come to the Burlington City Municipal, right? Strengthening the relationship between the City of Burlington and the school district is a key, because education also, we need to think about it differently in the 21st century. Education happens every single day, everywhere, and also vocational opportunities that exist for students who do not want to go to college. We have opportunities to explore, and as an educator, this is something that I will need to strive for, yes, and to make sure that our kids have access to the education of the 21st century, and also once they graduate or, you know, they have access to great jobs, and why not also pushing them to stay within Burlington.
Ali Jang is an independent member of the Burlington City Council, also one of six candidates running for mayor this year. Ali, thank you so much for being on with me this morning.
It was great. We miss you.
All right, you take care. We're going to take a break now for CBS News. When we come back, we're going to learn about what's happening at the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents, past and present, with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous, full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly, the Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Remember, you can still travel and not have to quarantine. You can roam far and wide and get to visit some wonderful places, all right here in Vermont. If you haven't availed yourself of some of the outstanding vistas, architectural gems, attractions, and museums in Vermont, now is a great time to do so, and you don't have to worry about big crowds. So let's visit another of those places that you need to add to your list. We're headed to Brattleboro and the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center, and our discussion is going to include Yes, Artful Ice Shanties. I'm not making that up. With me now is Museum Director Danny Lichtenfeld. Danny, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. So happy to be here.
Great. Listeners, if you have a question for Danny Lichtenfeld, or if you visited the Brattleboro Museum and want to share your thoughts, you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Danny, give us a little history lesson on the Brattleboro Museum.
The Brattleboro Museum was started almost 50 years ago, 1972, when Brattleboro's historic train station, which was built in 1915, but like many train stations around the state, around the country, had fallen into disrepair and disuse as train service kind of dried up in the late 60s. So the building was sitting there boarded up, and there began to be talk of tearing it down to make a parking lot, and there were two groups of people in the town of Brattleboro who said, do not do that. It's an important part of our architectural history and cultural legacy. We will put the effort in to repair it and put it back into use in some way that's valuable for the community. One group wanted to start a history museum about logging in the area and Native American history in the area. And another group wanted to have a space for art classes and art exhibitions and things. And so the town said, well, if the two of you can figure out how to work together on this, then sure, we're happy to make that building your problem. And so it became the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center. And originally that, you know, was indicative of the two different parts of the operation, the History Museum and the Art Center. Over time, as the organization has grown and professionalized, the focus has shifted entirely to art. So we are a contemporary art museum. We no longer have the historical artifacts and things like that. Those were given to the Brattleboro Historical Society sometime in the 80s. So that's how we got started. And so we still occupy historic Union Station. The rooms that used to be part of the train station operation, like the lobby or the men's smoking lounge and the ticket office and so on, all of those have been turned into galleries. So we have six galleries in the museum where we mount exhibits. We bring exhibits in and out about three times a year. So we do about 15 to 20 exhibits each year.
Now, you're preparing for a new exhibit. As a matter of fact, I think you're closed today to prepare for this. It's the Vermont Scholastic Art and Writing Awards. So tell us about that.
Yes, thank you for asking about that. This is something we do every year, and it's one of the things we're most proud of. The Scholastic Art and Writing Awards is a nationwide program. It's been in operation close to 100 years. It takes place all around the country. Every year, students in grades 7 through 12 are invited to submit artwork or writing in a variety of different categories. So it can be painting or prints or sculpture or video art or animation or poetry or nonfiction and so on and so on. And so throughout the country, students submit their work in the fall. And then the country is divided up into a whole bunch of different regions where the work is then judged. Vermont being a relatively small state, the entire state of Vermont is one region. And so we at the Brattleboro Museum, we're the affiliate for this national organization for the state of Vermont. So we organize this program each year for Vermont teenagers. So what that involves is encouraging these submissions and helping kids get their applications together. And then we assemble a panel of judges for art and for writing, and they review all of the work that comes in. And then there are several different levels of awards at the state level or regional level. Kids can get a gold key or a silver key or an honorable mention. And the award-winning work, we then get dropped off at our museum, which is why we're closed today. This is happening the last couple of days and today. all the award-winning work from around the state is delivered to the museum, and then we put it up as an exhibition that's up for about 3 weeks. And the kids who get a gold key at the state level, that work is then passed along to a set of national judges who consider it alongside the gold key winning work from all the other regions around the country. And then at that stage, the winners of the national awards can get college scholarships and national, you know, publication opportunities and exhibition opportunities. And we've had kids from Vermont who have won those highest awards nationally in the past few years. So it's an incredibly uplifting and inspiring thing to be part of this, to see what these Vermont teenagers are doing every year, and to have a chance to show their artwork at the museum for a few weeks. Normally, what we do is at the end of the three-week exhibition, we have an in-person award ceremony where the kids who have submitted writing will read from their writing submissions, and we have keynote speakers and so on. This year, that's all going to be virtual. That's going to be online on Saturday, March 6th at 12 noon. We'll just be streaming. It'll be pre-recorded, and then we'll be streaming it.
And I've got to view some of the selections online, and Danny, they are really outstanding.
I'll tell you.
Right?
I totally agree, Rick. And in fact, this year, I feel like they maybe are even a notch stronger this year than they have been in some years past. It's remarkable work what kids are doing around the state, and it's a testament not only to them and their abilities, but to their teachers and their families who are encouraging and enabling them to grow in this way. It's really amazing.
So you're getting that set up. When does that exhibit open?
That exhibit will be open for viewing starting tomorrow.
Oh, excellent.
And, and then through March 6th.
Now, Danny, my favorite Vermonter of all time is Snowflake Bentley. But one of the exhibits that you have right now is of, and I'll call him Iceman, Eric Hoffner. Yeah. Tell people about his beautiful work.
Well, your reference is completely apt. He's like a Snowflake Bentley for our era. Eric Hoffner is a photographer and journalist based in Western Massachusetts. And what we have up at the museum right now is a body of work that he's created over the past 20 years and that he's still continuing to add to and work on, where he goes out on the ice in the winter each morning and takes pictures of the ice fishing holes that were created the day before and that have frozen over overnight. So he takes these pictures from kind of close to the ice. So you see a circular shape, and they're all black and white. And then you see the most incredible patterns in the ice and designs. And if you don't know what you're looking at, your mind goes to, are these like views through a telescope of outer space? Or are these views through a microscope of inside a cell?
Right.
Like what exactly am I looking at here? And then when you read a little bit about it, or there's also a video playing in the gallery showing Eric out there on the ice, and you realize what you're looking at, it's just astonishing. And the most amazing patterns and shapes just formed by the ice freezing overnight. And one of the things that has really interested Eric, he's just doing this every year, every winter, he's going out and taking these pictures and adding to this body of work. In the last couple of years, he feels like the ice has been freezing really differently, and you can see it very clearly in the kinds of shapes that are being formed by the ice bubbles and things, which he suspects, may be a sign of warmer winters, thinner ice, as a result of climate change. But in any case, all the images are amazing, amazing to see.
Danny, we were talking ice and ice fishing. So another exhibit is Ice Shanties, Fishing, People, and Culture. What will people see there?
Oh, they'll see a really fascinating exhibit that was created by the Vermont Folklife Center in Middlebury. Terrific organization. A photographer named Federico Pardo from Colombia got interested in the ice shanties that appear on a body of water in Brattleboro that we call Retreat Meadows. It's where it's the mouth of the West River emptying out into the Connecticut River. And so he just took it upon himself to begin taking pictures of these shanties. And Federico is a wonderful photographer. He's worked for National Geographic and many other publications. So these are these beautiful photographs of the shanties taken with a long exposure at night. So you see the stars in the sky, but they're also vibrantly lit because of the long exposure. So the photographs are really wonderful in themselves. But after he had taken a number of these, Federico felt like, you know, he just really wasn't getting to the heart of the matter, that the real story to be told here had to do with the people who occupy these shanties mm-hmm. and who own them and use them for ice fishing. And so he got connected with a researcher at the Vermont Folklife Center named Ned Castle. And Ned undertook a process of interviewing the shanty owners and making audio recordings of those interviews. And so the exhibit consists of large, beautiful prints of these photographs on the gallery walls. And next to each photograph is a label, like a little different than a normal museum label. It's formatted as though it were an ice fishing license, a state of Vermont fishing license. And it has like the basic information about the image that you're looking at and whose shanty it is and when the photo was taken and so on. And then it also has a phone number you can call and an extension that you can dial to listen to a recording of the person whose ice shanty that is speaking about their involvement in ice fishing. And the stories are, some of them are really poignant and philosophical, and others are just hilarious stories of ice fishing misadventures. So together, seeing these beautiful photographs and hearing the stories, it's a really powerful exhibit.
All right. And then I think you've taken it one step further out at the retreat farm. This is so great.
Yeah, we have. You know, what happened here, whenever we have exhibits up at the museum, we spend some time, you know, thinking about what else can we do around this exhibit to give people a deeper dive into the issues or the, you know, better race with this particular exhibit. Mm-hmm. And often what that looks like is we're arranging panel discussions or talks or film screenings or something like that. But, you know, this year, for obvious reasons, we had the added motivation of thinking about what can we do outside, just because that's where, you know, it's safer right now and people right. are more comfortable gathering. And so so in Brattleboro, this body of water where the ice shanties are all set up, the Retreat Meadows, is just across the road from a nonprofit educational center called Retreat Farm. I think of it as like Brattleboro's smaller scale version of Shelburne Farms. Mm. And it's a great organization, and we've been talking with the people there about ways that we might collaborate on a project for a long time. And then we had the idea of, what about this? What if we invite the community to create whimsical, artful versions of ice shanties? And we can have them displayed right there, like across the road from the actual real ice shanties that are mm-hmm. that are out on the ice. And so the folks at Retreat Farm loved that idea. We put out the call, and then we just crossed our fingers and hoped that some people would be just crazy enough to put in all the effort and expense and time and everything to create some artful ice shanties. And sure enough, they did. And in fact, we gave them the option. We said, you know, if you're going to create a structure that you actually want to use for ice fishing, you can put it out on the ice rather than over here on dry land. But just to be clear, you're going to have to be responsible for keeping an eye on the weather and getting it on and off the ice as needed, because we don't have the capacity to do that. So in the final analysis, we ended up with 10 shanties.
Wow.
And one of them is out on the ice, and the owner of the shanty is using it for ice fishing. I'm so delighted to have visitors come walking out on the ice and then talk to them, you know, about ice fishing. And the other 9 are arranged on dry land just across the road from the retreat meadows and right in front of the retreat farm.
Ah, Danny, that's a brilliant idea. That's totally brilliant. This is outside, but the museum and art center inside, is it open to the public to view the exhibits they have right now?
Yeah, we are. Uh-huh. We're open normal hours, which are Wednesday through Sunday, 10 to 4. And we have capacity limits in place, of course, and visitors are able to make a reservation for a particular time if they want to do that, and be assured that they'll be able to visit at that time, or just show up and walk in. We're doing that too. And honestly, we have so much space that we're never at capacity. So it hasn't been difficult.
Good.
To remain open.
Prior to the pandemic, Danny, you released plans for an expansion for the museum. Is that still going on?
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. We released those plans in November of 2019, and then we really got our fundraising underway in earnest, and we got out of the gate pretty well. But then in March of 2020, when everything shut down, we paused the fundraising and for the project, and just decided we have to wait and see how this is going to play out.
Right.
What this means for our ability to raise the money to do that expansion project, but also what the lay of the land is going to be in Brattleboro and the area once the dust settles here on this major, traumatic event in our lives. Will the assumptions that were driving our project in the first place still be appropriate? Mm-hmm. And so we paused for a few months, and then we spent a few months having conversations with lots and lots of different people in the community to gauge whether it seemed like our project still made sense and was still feasible. And the upshot of that was, there were a few little things where we've decided to tweak about our plans, but overwhelmingly the message we heard from the community was, boy, if you guys can pull this off, that'll be better than ever. Like, now more than ever, that would be an incredibly helpful thing as we're all going to begin to recover from this pandemic. It would be great to have an expanded art center and the additional housing downtown that is going to come along with that, and the vitality that the project will bring to Brattleboro and the area. So we're just now about to resume our fundraising and move the project along.
And tell us a little bit about that expansion project.
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, the museum has been located since its inception in Brattleboro's historic train station. And we're kind of bursting at the seams in there. And in particular, we have extensive education programs that we do with schools in the area and with Head Start classrooms, and we don't really have adequate space to do those programs. So several years ago, we began thinking about what are our options here for adding space, and we also wanted to have some new additional gallery space and some other functions as well. And there's a little strip of property just across the road from our from Union Station, just across the road, and alongside the Whetstone Brook, where it comes down through Brattleboro and empties into the Connecticut River, that has an old boarded-up building, boarded-up 19th-century brick building that was once for power generation, and it has a little commercial building with a front on Main Street. And we acquired that property with the intention of having continuing to operate in our existing location, but building a new facility in this kind of underutilized and neglected little strip of property at the foot of Main Street and alongside the Whetstone Brook. And the new building that we've conceived will have on street level, like you'll enter it at the street level, and then because the ground drops off, there's another full floor below and a partial floor below that, but you're not going down into the ground because the ground drops off so steeply. So, so like 2.5 floors there, starting at street level and going down alongside the brook, will be new museum galleries and classrooms and rooms for workshops and demonstrations and all our education programs that we want to be able to offer. And on 2 or 3 floors up above will be apartments, mixed income apartments. And so we're partnered in this project with a local development firm called M&S Development based in Brattleboro. And they're the firm that's behind the revitalization of the Putnam Block in Bennington recently, and also when most of Brattleboro's Main Street burned down in, I think, 2011, a building called the Brooks House.
Right.
It was M&S Development that marshaled the resources to bring that historic building back to life. So they're a great local development firm with a commitment to downtowns and downtown vitality. And so we're partnered with them on this, and so they'll be primarily responsible for the housing up above the museum floors, and we'll be responsible for the museum portion of the expansion.
What an outstanding project, and good luck with that. Look forward to seeing that expansion happen. Danny Lichtenfeld is the director of the Brattleboro Museum and Arts Center. To learn about its exhibits, the website is brattleboromuseum.org. Great photo gallery. There's some video archives there that you'll enjoy. Danny, it's been great having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Rick, I can't thank you enough. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for your program.
Yep, it was our pleasure. Thanks, Danny. We're going to pop out for the CBS News break, and then we're going to come back. We'll have the open phones again. Today, we're going to talk art and food. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents past and present with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly, the Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. The phones, they are open. Over the last couple of days, we've heard from the owner of Art Etc. in Northfield, the producing artistic director of JAG Productions in White River Junction, and today the director of the Brattleboro Museum and Arts Center. So if you'd like to share an arts venue or an exhibit or event you recently enjoyed, please hop on the phone. Let us know. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Friday, we spoke with Chef Michael. Michael's on the Hill about cooking for your sweetheart. If you want to discuss what you made on Valentine's Day, if you want to let us know about your favorite Vermont restaurant, that would be fantastic. Or maybe some cooking tips of your own. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Yes, you guessed it. I didn't fill out the whole 2 hours today with guests, so we have of the open phones. As I mentioned yesterday, you can ask me a question and you probably won't get the right answer. You can ask my opinion on politics and definitely not get a satisfactory answer. It's your opportunity, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. VT Viewpoint at RadioVermont.com is where you can send that information. Now, yesterday, I had a very interesting call, and a woman called right at the end of the show and talked about the need in Vermont. There's a problem with our demographics, that we're getting older and older. And the point she was making was not only are we getting older, but that the fertility rate in Vermont is dangerously low. And as a matter of fact, it's the lowest in the country. And so one thing we talked about was we need to have more children here. We need to make more babies. And so let's get some mood music on here.
Let's get on. Let's love, baby. Let's get it on.
So I mentioned maybe we play a little Barry White every day and we can bring up that fertility rate. This is, of course, Marvin Gaye, Let's Get It On. And there's not much better make-out music than that. But, yeah, I think with our aging population, we'll do our part to try to put you in the mood. If we have to play that every day for you, we'll do that as well. Right now, we need some calls, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Go ahead, Marvin. That was yesterday. That call was certainly one from left field that I didn't expect, but certainly made a lot of sense about Vermont's demographics. We're getting older and a lot of needs for older individuals. How are we going to pay for that with a tax base that is getting older? We need younger people here. One of the things that we've tried to do is attract younger couples to Vermont, younger people to come here and put down some roots and become Vermonters and live and work and enjoy it here. But we also need to have more children because we are number 50 out of 50 in the fertility rate of the states in the U.S. So we're not doing our part in that regard. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We can open up the trading post for you again. If you got something to sell, you're looking for something, you can use this opportunity. Maybe you don't get up at 6:30 to join Lee Cattell and me to get a listing in. You can do that now. Pretty wide open phones. I'd love to hear, though, about the arts, maybe someplace you love to go that I have not found yet that you want to tell us about, some wonderful artist in Vermont that we should all know about, or a restaurant or food that you enjoy. Maybe it's something, great ethnic food that's been handed down from your family that you want to tell us about that you make. I throw my hat in the ring every once in a while and try to make halupki, and that is the Polish call it gołąbki, your cabbage rolls, you know, your stuffed cabbage, and I'll do that at home sometimes, kielbasa and sauerkraut. I have a Slovak background, so you get those Eastern European dishes. I don't try to make pierogi myself. I have a friend who makes the best pierogi this side of my grandmother, and so I let her do that and buy it from her. All right, so we're going to get a call in here soon, and we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Lost both those calls? All right, that just makes me have to talk more and more and more, and you do not want me to start singing Marvin Gaye, or that would be some real problem for all of us. So we are at 877-291-8255, 244-1777, and we're going to start things off with Bill in Moortown. Hey, Bill.
Good morning. I just happened to get come in here and started listening to your radio.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Where in Vermont is the closest German or the restaurant where we can get pierogies or something like that made up? Do you know?
Oh, pierogi? Well, so I get pierogi from a woman in the Chittenden area, and she sometimes will be different places. Like she's been in Waterbury at the center, you know, the tasting center, and her name is Louisa's Made with Love. You can find her online as well. Louisa's Homemade with Love. And she makes the best pierogi since my own grandmother's. And she does, Bill, she does potato and cheese, she does sauerkraut, probably does a few others. But I can get you in touch. If you email me at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, I'll give you the information on how you can find those pierogi, and you will thank me 1,000 times.
Okay, I thank you very much. By golly, that's just down the road. What did you say the place is in Waterbury?
Well, so there have been times that she'll go and she'll set up a stand at the tasting center where Lake Champlain Chocolates is, and you know, so that right there on Route 100, I call it the tasting center. Cabot Cheddar was there as well.
Okay, I'm with you now, by golly. Stop in next time I go up through there.
All right, I'll let you know when she's there again. All right. Oh, if you've never had pierogi. Mm. So I grew up with it back where I'm from in the Pennsylvania area. It's, you know, the Polish make it, the Germans, and every nationality, every country has their form of dumpling. You know, you have ravioli, you've got samosas, you've got different things like that. But in Eastern Europe, it is pierogi and wonderful dough filled with, I grew up with potato and cheese. That's the main one, but you can fill it with just about anything. Sauerkraut's delicious. You boil them first, fry them in a little butter, some onions, top it with a little bit of salt and some sour cream, and you are in heaven. Indeed, you are. I do want to comment on one call that we had yesterday. I always ask that you be respectful during calls, and we all have to understand that our opinions are right for us, but they will collide and diverge from others who listen and others who live here. And as much as you want people to respect your opinions, you must respect theirs. And that goes for the language we use and the words we choose. Some terms now have more weight than others and say much more than the word itself because of the meaning that's become attached to it. So please choose your words carefully when offering your opinion in public and on this show and on this station. I fully respect the rights of individuals to protest, to hold up signs, and to chant. But I don't believe protest should result in destruction of property, injury to individuals, and attacking of our public safety officers. Whether that's at the U.S. Capitol, whether it's in Portland, Oregon, or whether it's in Burlington, Vermont. And I know as host of the show, I've kind of set myself up as the arbiter of what is respectful and what is not. So I apologize in advance if I feel as if I have to step in and curtail someone's comments. I'll try to tread softly, softly, but I also will not subject the other people tuning into this show and this station to what is widely considered offensive terms towards any groups or individuals. I want to thank you all for allowing me to explain myself. All right, let's get some calls. We got Dee in Duxbury. Hi, Dee.
Hi. You were talking about German restaurants.
Yes.
And I know of a restaurant in Derby that's not German. It's the cook is from Austria.
Oh.
And is not open now, but it'll be open in March.
Okay.
And it's called the Derby Village Inn, and it's wonderful.
Oh, really? Is there a dish there that you really will recommend for people? You there, Dee? Oh, we lost Dee. Okay. All right. So, Bill, if you're still listening, and Bill's in Moortown, Dee's in Duxbury. They might even hop in the car and commute together, take a ride up to the border there, to Derby, to the Derby Village Inn. Supposed to be wonderful. As a matter of fact, I think I have a friend who had her wedding there, or had them cater her wedding, and said it was absolutely phenomenal. So, Dee, I think you're spot on in telling us about the Derby Village Inn. It's Austrian, not German, Bill, but I think there's probably enough similarity. And remember, good food is good food, no matter what country it comes from. So, Bill, head north to the border. Starting in March is when Dee says we can all eat at the Derby Village Inn again, and great Austrian food. So, it's probably phenomenal. All right, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Getting a little lonely here. Going to really have to talk for the next 8.5 minutes. You're really going to get bored with me, because I'll start trotting out some really arcane stuff, like yesterday's explanation of how we get energy from cheese water. And that was for our friend Wade in, I believe, Moortown. I hope he heard that yesterday. So, Wade, if you didn't, it can happen, and I explained how, and I'll have to do it again sometime when I want to put everybody to sleep. But it's really a thing, and that's what they're doing over in Cabot, at Cabot Cheddar, with that biodigester. So they really can make energy from the wastewater, from the whey water, actually, of the cheese process. All right, here we go. The phones are starting to light up. Nobody wants to hear me talk too much. We're going to start in Greensboro, and we've got David. Hi, David. You there, David?
Yes.
Okay, go right ahead.
Yes.
Help me out here.
I've been listening to...
Oh, your radio. You should probably turn that down.
You remind me of what I used to do, and now I'm going to go turn off the radio.
Okay,
because I'm hearing myself twice and you three times.
And nobody wants to do that. All right.
Okay.
David, you turn that down, and we'll get you hooked up here.
I'm 81 years old, and for most of that time, I lived in Greensboro operating the Highland Lodge.
Oh, okay.
We sold that a few years ago, and now I just sit and listen to the radio.
Okay.
But I thought you should hear one of the ads that I used to do.
Oh, I'd love it.
I did them for WDEV. These were the cross-country ads.
Mm-hmm.
And here's one. Our morning muffins are unbelievable. Years of experience and hot competition among our chefs give you a taste treat that you will always remember, especially if you just rolled out of bed and down the stairs for your Green Mountain coffee and found your muffin. They have satisfied the Ladies Walking Society of Greensboro for years. Call any one of them for a referral to the Highland Lodge, where the skiing begins, in Greensboro.
Oh,
that's just one of about a dozen that I used to do.
Oh, David, I love it so much.
And I'm glad to be able to say that all again.
Wow. When did you when did you sell the Highland Lodge?
When did you sell the Highland Lodge?
Oh, you're back on the radio.
3 years ago.
Oh, okay. Wow, so you had it for a long time.
And so, by the way, I can't hear you on my telephone, so I'll have to go back to the radio.
All right, let's try it now. Can you hear me now, David?
Oh, yeah.
All right. You know, our board is, every once in a while, we get a button pushed and, you know, or unpushed, and sometimes that happens. So we didn't mean to do that to you, David, so I apologize.
You did get the ad.
I did, yeah. We heard you loud and clear, and I want a morning muffin right now. I was trying to keep account of how many puns you got in there about the buns, so but that was a lot of fun. Wow. Would you come down to DEV and record them here, or?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow.
I even have tapes of my recordings way back then. But would you like to hear another one?
Please do. You're the show right now, David. Go ahead. I love it.
Okay. It won't take you long to make a great choice for dinner. Everything we do is special. We make our own bread and dinner rolls, salad dressings, fresh meats and vegetables, and really different cheeses from our neighbors. fish from the North Atlantic. Wonderful desserts. Soak up the warmth and drift on home with your honey, or stay with us at the Highland Lodge, where the skiing begins, in Greensboro.
Oh, wow. Now, David, did you do any of the cooking? Were you a chef at all? Or?
No, my wife assisted my mother for some 30 years.
Wow. And what was your favorite dish there?
Ishkabibble.
Ishkabibble.
That was a dessert. It came from Pennsylvania. But as I think...
Must have been Pennsylvania
Dutch. I know what the best one was.
Yep.
Glop. G-L-O-P. It was a mix of all sorts of interesting things. And I did one just a couple of weeks ago for the Ladies Walking Society here in Greensboro.
And tell me about them, because I'm not familiar. I'm not a native Vermonter. What is the Ladies Walking Society?
These are women who don't want to stay at home when their husbands or when the house is empty.
Mm-hmm.
So they get together from time to time, and it used to be in specific places depending on the day of the week. But generally, when they came to the lodge, it was at a dinner time or a breakfast time, something like that, to get them started before they headed out. And this wasn't just in the summer. It was also skiing. In the fall, they would get out on the trails and cut the trails for cross-country skiing.
Oh, my.
We had a real community gathering at the Highland Lodge, and we did a lot of good work, and we were all well-exercised. As you can tell from my voice, I'm still strong.
You sound
after
great.
After 81 years.
I would never guess that you were 81. I thought you were a young man when you called. And, you know, you also showed you have some hops because you got over and turned that radio down and got back on without even hearing me and did a great job with a couple of the ads. Did you write all those ads for the Highland Lodge back then?
Yes.
Oh, that's phenomenal. Wow. Sounds like you had a great time running the place.
Here's another one you'll
All right, one more. We got time for one more.
We think you have a hard enough time working at home without working on vacation as well. When you watch the birds at your feeder, do you wish someone would take care of you like that? Well, we do. We've been taking care of hungry skiers for 42 years. Take some time for yourself and be our guest this winter. We'll cook for you. We'll build you a fire to sit by after a day of skiing. At the Highland Lodge on Caspian Lake in Greensboro.
Oh, David, I want you to reopen. I want you to go back into the business. I want to come up there and have some ishkabibble and stay the night.
Well, they're still open down there. I say that because our house is up above the lodge.
Uh-huh.
We look across the lodge and Caspian Lake and the hills beyond. But they're only open... on special days now. I think just weekends.
I got you. Well, David, I really appreciate your call today. This was a lot of fun. You take care and call again sometime.
I will. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Take care. Bye. That'll do it for today. Thanks again, dear listeners. Thank you very much, David. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEV Radio. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.